with support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Cranard Center for the Performing Arts. The 2004-2005 schedule of music, dance, opera, and theatrical events at Cranard Center is available by contacting the Cranard Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or 800-KCPATIX, 800-527-2849. Information is also available on the web at CranardCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning telephone talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Dansel, Jason Croft is at the controls. For something like 100 years, women have been taking estrogen to combat the effects of menopause. In more recent years, it was prescribed by doctors who felt that it would be preventive and help women avoid a number of conditions, including osteoporosis and heart disease. However, a couple of years ago, back in 2002, a major study found that long-term use of hormones could actually increase the risk of heart disease and breast cancer, along with some other conditions. The question that we'll talk about this morning is, was this widespread use of estrogen a mistake? Our guest for the program is Barbara Seaman. She is a journalist, women's health advocate, someone who for a long time now has been raising questions about the potential hazards of supplementation of estrogen. She has been a national judge of the Project Censored Awards. This is something that has been happening now every year, looking at stories that are big stories that some people at least think the media has ignored. She's been an advanced science writing fellow at Columbia University School of Journalism. She's co-founder of the National Women's Health Network, a women's advocacy group in Washington, D.C. She's a frequent contributor to the New York Times, the Washington Post. She's been either a columnist or a contributing editor at a number of publications, including Ms., Omni, Family Circle. She's the author of a book that came out a number of years ago that turned out to be pretty influential in people's thinking about oral contraception. The title of that book is The Doctor's Case Against the Pill. And she's here with us this morning by telephone to talk about a book that came out last year, a book that's titled The Greatest Experiment Ever Performed on Women, Exploding the Estrogen Myth. That's the subtitle, and it's published by Hyperion. It takes a look at some of the history behind estrogen use and also some of what we know now about the potential hazards of hormonal replacement therapy, at least when we're talking about estrogen. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana. You'd like to call in 333-9455. Also, we do have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just are brief. We just ask that so that we can get in as many different callers as possible and kind of keep things moving. But of course, anyone listening is welcome to call. Ms. Seaman, hello.
Hello, David. I've heard on the grapevine. By the way, I'm really sorry that I live in New York and I can't get to hear your show, but I hear that you're that rare bird that actually reads your guests' books. Is this true?
Someone told you that? Well, I don't know how rumors like that get started. We try. We certainly try. We feel that we owe that to the guests and to the audience.
That's amazing. Half the people who write book reviews don't even read the books.
Well, I can't speak for anybody else but myself. I guess I'm not sure how you would do it if you didn't at least spend a few hours looking at the work of the people that you were talking to. So,
Well, you deserve a medal.
That's very kind. Maybe you might want to talk a little bit about how far back your interest in this particular issue, and that is some hormones go. Because I think in everything I read about you, it says that probably longer than anybody else, any other journalist, this has been something that you've been writing about and talking about.
Yes, I have been called the Helen Thomas of hormones. I first went on the estrogen beat put myself on the estrogen beat in 1960 when the pill was approved as a contraceptive. So that means I've been doing this for 44 years. Oh, my God. And what got me interested was that my Aunt Sally, my father's twin sister, died of endometrial cancer in 1959. She was still in her late 40s. And she was in Memorial Hospital, New York's Memorial Hospital, which is a very famous cancer center. And as she was dying, and it was an awful death, her sisters and her nieces were all gathered around her oxygen tent. And her doctors kept wanting to talk to us about estrogen and the fact that, my Aunt Sally was taking Premarin. People think this is a relatively newer drug, but it's amazing. It was actually approved by the FDA, Premarin was, in 1942, May 1942. So it had been on the market quite a long time when she died from endometrial cancer. And it was known. It was known to the cancer doctors, at least, that that this product that was given to treat hot flashes was lethal for some women. So I remember saying to the doctor who told us all that as her relatives we should never take Premarin because we might have the same susceptibilities, I remember I said to him, I don't understand this. She was given the Premarin for her hot flashes. Did anybody ever die of hot flashes or of menopause? And he said, well, no, not as far as he knew. I said, well, then why would doctors be giving women something that could kill them in this gory way just for something that isn't life-threatening? And he said, well, my great mentor often asked the same question. And he pulled a clipping out of his wallet, an old clipping, and it was from the Journal of the American Medical Association. His mentor had been George Papanicolaou, the doctor who invented the pap smear, which was perhaps the greatest preventive test on women's health that has ever been devised. And George Papanicolaou had tried very hard to stop the FDA from ever approving estrogen products for general use until much more was known about it. And during the late 1930s and early 40s, he kept writing editorials in the medical journals about it, and he kept submitting evidence that it was carcinogenic. So I was convinced back in the late 1950s that women were having a bit of a fraud perpetrated on them. Mm-hmm. And then when the pill came out, within a year of my aunt's death, and I realized that it included estrogen that was quite similar to what they were given for menopause, I said, well, I better look into this, and that's how it got started.
Yeah, and I guess just to round out the point about the contraceptive, because you did write this book about that, in the early versions of the contraceptive, they contained much, much higher doses of hormone than it does now. When they found out they could achieve the same effect with much less hormone in the pill, and early on it was creating a lot of problems for a lot of women.
And I knew, well, I was very fortunate in the quality of the mentors I managed to find. I mean, I learned a lot about the Premarin through a close student of Dr. Papanicolaou. And then when the pill came out, I learned that a man named Sir Charles Dodds, who was president of the Royal College of Physicians in England, was spending his presidential years going around the country and warning, around the world, in fact, warning doctors not to give young women the pill because so little was known about it. And this was in the early 60s, and he would say that we don't understand enough about the female reproductive system to give long-term hormone therapy to healthy women. It's just wrong. Now, he had invented one of the estrogen products, and but he had thought it would be only used for people with severe problems, for example, little girls who were born without ovaries, and maybe very briefly for women who'd had their ovaries removed surgically to help get them through a very short time of huge discomfort. Hmm. So I contacted him and asked him if he could answer some of the questions my readers were asking. At that point, I was doing a column in Brides Magazine and a column in the Ladies' Home Journal. I was also helping Joyce Brothers with her TV program questions that she was getting on the pill. The pill was a very big topic in the 60s. And Sir Charles Dodds was wonderful. He We had a very flourishing relationship talking about the pill, and he even helped me answer my readers' questions in the women's magazines. It was quite extraordinary. And he told me at the time that he believed the amount of estrogen that was being used in the pill was about 8 or 10 times higher than was needed for contraception. That was what his research had indicated to him. And he said, please tell people that. This is bizarre, and there are all these pulmonary embolisms and strokes and heart attacks and terribly serious clots in the legs, and it could be greatly reduced if they lowered the dosage. So I had no hesitation about telling my readers and telling people when I gave talks that that this seemed like it was a huge overdose, and they had not taken an extra 6 months a year to get it down to find out the lowest possible dose that would be effective, and I thought that this was causing a lot of havoc. And it turned out, I can't say I was right, I can only say Sir Charlie Dodds was right, but I was his messenger who brought this information to the American public. And by the late 60s, I had so much reader mail that I wrote a whole book, The Doctor's Case Against the Pill, and then Senator Gaylord Nelson based hearings on my book. And as a result of the hearings, we did get a warning on the patient labeling. It was the first time with any prescription drug that patients were told what symptoms to watch out for that might be serious so that they should quickly get off the medication. So that was a great breakthrough, I thought. Because to me, the big issue is informed consent and full disclosure. People can take any kind of medicine they want to take. I mean, it's up to them. As long as they know what the benefits and risks really are, if they're being snookered by marketing tactics, or if there's selective disclosure, which is a term that Attorney General Elliot Spitzer has been using a lot lately. He's suing drug companies for failing to tell the truth about various products. He's particularly interested right now in the antidepressant products. But in any case, this selective disclosure that the drug companies do really almost started with the hormone companies. They hired a lot of PR people who had formerly worked for the tobacco industry, and they just learned how to spin and counterspin and present things not exactly the way they really were.
It's a really fascinating story, the story of the making and distributing of hormones, and it actually goes back to the man that you talk about, and it goes back before World War II, when scientists working in Nazi Germany were working on using hormones for contraception. This man, Charles Dodds, when the word got out that the Nazis scientists were doing this kind of work, he, and I'm sure others, didn't want them to be able to corner the market. So he published his own formula for this. He put it out there in public. He gave it away, gave up any rights that he would have had to patent it because he didn't want the Germans to have it. So it became widely available. But at the same time, he, and I think this, as you say, this concern grew over time, he was very concerned about possible hazards connected with it. So even back before he was, what is it not true that even back before World War II, back at that time, he was saying, look, this is something that one ought to use very carefully and only a restricted set of circumstances?
That's right. He published the formula for his estrogen, which was diethylstilbestrol, known in this country as DES, and of course it had very tragic consequences. Mm-hmm. He published it in 1938, and he rushed it into print because a Schering in Germany had just patented ethanol estradiol, which, as it turns out, ethanol estradiol is still the product, the estrogen product, that's in more than 90% of the birth control pills in the world today. In other words, the most popular and probably most effective contraceptive estrogen was actually developed in Germany and patented in 1937. And Hitler at the time was very interested in racial cleansing. And he wanted to get rid of the Jews, he wanted to get rid of the Gypsies, he wanted to get rid of families that had children with handicaps, and they were really looking for products that would sterilize people. So Charlie was hearing a lot about this, Charlie Dodds, because he was a big international biochemist. He had both a PhD and an MD, and he was head of a big research lab, and he was a consultant to King George. And he went to all the, and he was a very lovely man, very friendly, very kind, exuberant, and he went to a lot of international biochemistry and medical conferences. He made friends, and he had started getting a lot of letters from scientists in Germany who wanted to know if he could help them get out and get jobs outside of Germany. Many of them were Jewish, but not all of them. There were a lot of people that weren't Jewish who were frightened of Hitler. And so he realized what was happening, and he became very concerned. He passed a lot of information to Winston Churchill, by the way. He was a great fan of Winston Churchill's. He was very worried about the appeasement that England was practicing for a time concerning Hitler. And so as soon as he got the, so he really put the gas on the pedal to finish up his, he'd been working for years and years on the diethylstilbestrol, which was a synthetic estrogen that was very cheap to manufacture and that was powerful enough to take by mouth. And he actually got help from some of his other colleagues to finish it up really fast after the Germans patented the ethanol estradiol. They were sure, the Brits were sure that the Germans were going to try to corner the world market on hormone products. And so he published it. He gave away his formula. He published the whole formula in Nature magazine, which is a great British science magazine. And he was shocked that within a year, there were hundreds of small drug companies all over the world that were making it already. He totally lost control of it, and he became quite frantic. He started sending out vials. Well, he noticed that the men in his lab, the workers in his lab who handled the estrogen powder, were growing breasts. And the way he knew that was in those days men wore suspenders, and he could see their shirts were starting to billow out under their suspenders. And he knew a lot about cancer. He knew that that meant that it was really overstimulating the mammary tissue. So he sent out samples of his DES to his the most respected cancer researchers he knew. He sent them to people in the United States and France and so on. And all of these findings found out that that it was carcinogenic. And one of the people who was testing it, of course, was the inventor of the Pap smear, Dr. Papanicolaou, as I mentioned before. And so there were loads of papers published on the carcinogenicity of this product, and yet he couldn't stop. He was unable to stop people from using it casually. He did think, he finally came to the conclusion that if a woman had very severe menopause symptoms, she and was really suffering so that she couldn't function, the safest way to take this would be to take it until you could start with a low dose, go up a bit until her flashes got better or got to a point where she could stand them, and then as soon as it was under control, start tapering off as quickly as you could start to taper off, but do it very slowly. Spend a whole year tapering it off, and at the end of the year, if she's tapered off slowly, she probably won't have the flashes come back. This is a very important thing to tell women now who are trying to get off and having difficulty. I think that perhaps if they took it much more slowly, they would be able to get off without having a backlash. And the other thing that drove him crazy, he called them the crazy people in America, was that they were right from the time he published his formula, there were people who started to give the his diethylstilbestrol to pregnant women on the grounds that it would help them grow bigger and healthier babies and that it would prevent miscarriages. And one of the main people behind this was a very important gynecologist. He was head of the gynecology department at Harvard. And when he said that he was doing it, and he gave papers saying this would be a wonderful thing, almost all pregnant women should be given it, it became very popular, and it was given to about 4 million pregnant women in this country. And that started in the 40s, in the early, mid-40s. And by 1971, it was discovered that the not only were all the mice and rats and rabbits getting cancer, and not only were their children getting reproductive abnormalities, you know, the pups, if you gave it to a pregnant rat or mouse, her pups would be born with strange abnormalities in their reproductive organs. They called it intersexuality. Sometimes in these studies you couldn't even tell whether the pups were males or females because there were so many distortions. In 1971, it was made clear that in the humans, too, some of the daughters got a rare and very lethal cancer. And then it was, and many of them died. And it was a cancer in the vagina. And then it was found that most of the daughters had misshapen uteruses and other problems that could affect their infertility. And the sons had a lot of infertility problems, too. So poor Charlie Dodds, who had tried endlessly to stop this practice, he died a very broken man in 1973. During the 60s, he kept telling me something terrible is going to happen. I don't know why it hasn't happened yet, but all of this promiscuous use of the estrogen products, he said, is going to lead to something terrible.
I should probably introduce our guest again, and we have some callers I'd like to bring into the conversation. We're talking with Barbara Seaman. She has been writing as a journalist about women's health for more than 40 years. She's contributed to the New York Times and Washington Post. She's been a columnist or contributing editor at a number of publications, including Ms., Omni, Ladies Home Journal, Family Circle. She is the author of the book, The Doctor's Case Against the Pill, a book that's been out for quite a while.
And I'll say.
For something like 25 years, I think?
35 years. I'm 35. About to update it for a 35th edition.
Okay. So that book is out there and soon to be in an updated edition. And then the book here we're talking about this morning that's actually was published last summer.
The paperback just came out.
Paper. Okay. So now if you want to read it, you can read it in paper because it tells the story that she was just telling in greater detail and goes also into the issue of where we are now with hormonal supplementation. The book is titled The Greatest Experiment Ever Performed on Women, and it's published by Hyperion. And we do have a couple of callers here who've been waiting patiently to talk with us, so let's do that. Urbana is first, line number one. Hello.
Hi, is this me?
Yes.
I'm enjoying this conversation a lot, and I just had a few questions. I'm a 50-year-old woman who's been having hot flashes for about a year. I'm very determined not to do any hormone therapy and haven't. I had a question about the so-called phytoestrogens that are so popular now. Everybody talks about soy, and if you go into a health food store, there's range of products from things that you take orally to creams that you rub on yourself. And I wondered if you had any opinion about the efficacy and the safety of those. And I guess related to that, I wondered whether you were familiar with any successful other treatments that are safe for hot flashes. Since I hear you when you say that hot flashes aren't life-threatening, but they can certainly be very disorienting.
Yes.
And very disrupting of life in a general sort of way.
Mm-hmm. Well, are yours so severe that you aren't functioning normally?
No, I can function.
The doctor.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So that's. I mean, so I don't consider it, you know, that serious a thing. It's just that there are times when it sort of seems to be happening constantly to me. So if I could do things that would alleviate it that I thought were safe, I would try it. I've already, you know, I know that alcohol and caffeine and other things can exacerbate it, so I avoid those things. So I just wondered what your opinion of that was.
Well, it just happens that my book has a long index where it discusses all the alternatives, mm-hmm. and or at least the commonly used alternatives.
Okay.
And what we know and don't know about them. And briefly, I would say this, that there are other things that help a lot. The only one that I think is really safe, that in many years has not been associated with any serious complications, is vitamin E. Maybe you're taking it, but a certain percentage of women, whose particularly if their hot flashes are annoying but not overwhelming, find that if they take fairly high levels of vitamin E, 200, 400 units a day, some go up to 800, although I wouldn't do that if it were me.
Right.
It really reduces the hot flashes quite a lot.
Okay.
Other people say the same about oil of evening primrose. But vitamin E has had some fairly good studies made on it over the years.
Okay.
And some of them don't find that it's too effective, but quite a few of them have found that it's effective. Of course, it could very well be that there are different kinds of vitamin E being used, or it's taken on different schedules. Who knows? Now, with all of these other methods, the problem is, and that's everything from, by the way, as far as the soy goes, I think people are starting to believe that this, it's not a good idea to take soy products, that it's too intense, but that perhaps just eating more soy in your diet might be a good idea.
Yeah.
But basically, there's also some feeling that, that almost anything that's good for the hot flashes, many of these products are actually hormonal in their effects, particularly estrogenic, and therefore they might have the same long-term bad effects that the estrogen products themselves have. We just don't know because they haven't been properly studied.
Right.
And so that brings me to the to the actual figures. There have been some good studies, I think, that have shown over and over that somewhere about 12 to 15%, something like 1 in 6 women, have such, in our culture, have such severe menopause symptoms that it really disturbs the quality of their life. I mean, if somebody is a businesswoman or a teacher or what have you, and she's just flashing all the time, she can't really... It can make it very, very difficult for her, or if her night sweats are so bad that she just can't sleep. By the way, I recently participated in a conference on women, cancer, and hormones at Harvard. It was a seminar, and there were 20 people there. And there were medical historians, there were doctors, and there were scientists. And there were two very... smart, attractive women physicians who looked to be in their 40s, early 50s, and they were both sitting there and regularly taking out their fans and fanning themselves very hard. So it was made very clear to the rest of us that they had voted no against taking the hormones.
Right.
And that they had decided that in their world of university medical people, it was okay to sit there and fan.
Yeah.
Or in other offices, I've seen people turning up the air conditioning, and then people who aren't going through menopause turn it down. But the basic thing to remember is that about 1 woman in 6 says that she is so incapacitated that it's worth taking a risk for her to use these products. And nobody could quarrel with that. We all take drugs that actually have some downside. I mean, there's almost, you know, it's like the law of physics. The more the action, the more the reaction.
Right. Well, that all makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So it's you know, only the user can decide. But I feel that the risks are great enough so that everybody should really know what all the potential risks are, and that would help her decide for herself whether it's worth it.
Yeah.
For her, and the hormone selling was so brilliant that whereas there were if only the women having severe menopauses were taking hormone products in the United States, there would have been about 1.5 to 2 million women taking it at any given time. Instead, you know, before the halting of the Prempro trial, there were close to 20 million women taking hormone products.
Yeah.
So it shows that only about 1 woman in 10 really needed it medically.
Right.
Kind of shocking.
Do you have any opinion about short-term use of estrogen?
Well, now that's I'm so glad you brought that up because there is, it's embargoed and I can't tell you where it's going to be published, but next week you may be hearing news about a study that used, imaging to, a computer model that it's a very interesting study which tries to show whether short-term use is, safe.
Yes.
And they concluded that short-term therapy does increase the quality of life for women with menopausal symptoms. But it also shortens their life expectancy by a little bit, you know, by a few months.
Yeah.
So even because there have been these people saying, oh, it's all right to take it in the short term. You know, everybody, a lot of people started saying that after the halting of the trial.
Right.
But then the fact is, if you looked at the papers carefully, you sound like you might have been someone who was actually reading the scientific reports, were you?
Well, I've had discussions with physicians. And, for example, my personal physician told me that she believes that it's a matter, as you say, of risk-benefit, and that, you know, for example, if you're not overweight and if you're not diabetic and you don't have high blood pressure and you don't have a family history of strokes, et cetera, if you go on a short-term, very low-dose treatment of estrogen, that probably it's not a risk for you. I mean, that she actually said that to me several months ago, and she encouraged me to try it. I did not, because I'm just very skeptical.
Well, the problem is that there are some women who don't have any bad history of blood clots or anything, and yet it's in the first 6 months or year that you get the highest amount of the heart attacks from in women who've gone on the HRT.
Mm-hmm.
So that could happen. That happens sometimes to,
right.
now
but
and then to somebody very unexpectedly. Right. Then with the breast cancer, there's a funny thing that happens there, too. Apparently, they were not able to look as closely as they wanted to at the history of whether these women in the Women's Health Initiative, how long they might have been on the birth control pills. But, you know, the birth control pills, particularly if women take them when they're very young, seem to contribute to breast cancer, at least for as long as the women are on the pills.
Yeah.
Then when they go off, the breast cancer risk seems to go down again. But it may be that when they, if they then go back onto other estrogen products, the cancer is apt to come out more quickly. Nobody really knows yet. I mean, it's amazing to me that in all these years that these products have been on the market, the estrogen products since 1941 and 2, the pill since 1960, and in all these years, a lot of the questions that women would really care about just weren't asked. They avoided doing the right studies.
That is amazing.
It's deplorable.
Yeah. Well, thank you
so
very
I hope you'll take a look at the at my book and at the appendix in the back that tells about what we know about the all these other products that are being substituted.
Yeah. I will definitely do that. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on here. The next caller in line would be in Champaign in line two. Hello.
Hi. I'm going to ask a question about the production of knowledge and politics of pharmaceuticals, and maybe it will lead to something about fascism and corporate power and its connections. But anyway, I was actually reading a book recently called Love in the Kingdom. It's by an Egyptian writer, Nawal Saadawi, who talks about class patriarchy and the oil economy in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to kind of, in passing, mention then about the kind of production of knowledge that the 9/11 Commission has been talking about. Maybe it's called imperialist knowledge, I don't know. But about Iraq and about, you know, the arguments for justifying going to war and whether they were valid and whether there was a groupthink or whatever was going on. But I guess I want to bring these kind of issues to your work about the production of knowledge and the previous paradigms about women or how those paradigms affects that production of knowledge in a patriarchy or in a capitalist society.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the patriarchy question, because the fact is that even today we would not know about the serious problems with PREMPRO and HRT if not for a feminist intervention. What happened was that there was never any product approved by the FDA for heart disease prevention in men that wasn't based on a really good clinical trial. Even aspirin had a large clinical trial before the FDA went ahead and said to the aspirin manufacturers, you can go ahead and market this as being effective in reducing heart attacks. Now, with women, all of the trials on and all of the scientific reports on the effects of estrogen, the benefits, were just observational trials. There were no clinical trials done. And observational trials means that they just compare women taking it with women not taking it. Well, in fact, who is it that takes a sort of a luxury drug like the estrogen? It's women who are affluent and educated. They're taller and richer, and they exercise more, and they smoke less. And if you look at the women who were taking it and the women who weren't taking it, there was a huge discrepancy in social status. When I was getting my advanced science writing degree at the Columbia Journalism School, I took a public health course where my professor said that the biggest a predictor of a long life is affluence, and second is education, and the biggest predictor of an early death is poverty and lack of education. So there you go. So the real reason behind the women having less heart disease from the observational style trials is that they were they were much more fortunate women. Plus, the women who had a medical history of blood clots, of high blood pressure, of diabetes, and so on, were usually kept off these estrogen drugs because the warnings from the manufacturers even said, use with caution if women have had blah, blah, blah. So not only were the women not taking it a group who were less favored, but they were also a group who had more risk factors to start with. So the whole thing was very questionable, but nobody admitted it. And in 1990, when Wyeth Arist came to the FDA and they asked for permission to market Premarin to prevent heart disease in women, a young woman named Cynthia Pearson, who is now the executive director of the National Women's Health Network, she was then the program director, she did her homework, and she went to testify at the hearings that the FDA was holding, and she said, she told them about the aspirin. She said this cannot be, she said, this is sexism. Women have to be given the same standard in pre-market testing and claims that men have. And she said, you can't approve this until you do a trial, a real clinical trial, with, you know, double blind, you know, and neither the doctors nor the patients knew who was getting the real medicine and who was just getting a placebo. So actually the advisory board at the FDA voted to go ahead and give the drug company the right to advertise that it would that estrogen would prevent heart disease in women. But the actual little crew, the staff people at the FDA, who were not embedded with the drug companies, most of the people who get on the advisory boards are also people that do research for the drug companies, unfortunately. All of that is coming to light now. I think there's a big washout going on with a lot of the medicines being questioned. But Cynthia Pearson convinced this little group at the FDA staff that they couldn't approve it until a real clinical trial was done. Now, at that point in history, there were some people at the NIH who wanted to do a clinical trial, but they hadn't gotten the funding for it. And because Cindy persuaded the FDA staff to say, well, we can't go ahead and approve it until there's a clinical trial, at that point, Congress decided to allot the money for the clinical trial. That was in 1990 and 91. So that was how the WHI came to pass. And if it wasn't for the National Women's Health Network and Cindy, and also other feminist pressures, there were women in Congress who said there's a double standard, they're not doing clinical trials on women. There were women at the NIH who were saying the same thing. So because it was a moment where women said, well, we want equal treatment, that's the only reason that the truth about the estrogens began to come out. So, yes, you're right about the sexism.
We just have about, we're moving into our last 15 minutes, and I have some other callers, and I want to continue, and also again to introduce our guest, Barbara Seaman, has been a journalist, a women's health advocate, writing about this issue, these issues for quite a long time. Her most recent book is titled The Greatest Experiment Ever Performed on Women, Exploding the Estrogen Myth. It's published by Hyperion, and it is in bookstores now. In fact, it's just come out in paper. It was originally published, first published last summer in hardcover, now out in paper. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here. Next, someone in southern Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you for your talk. And I was, like the previous caller, interested if there's been any studies on natural substances like compounding pharmacists that do wild yam and turn that into an estrogen, and whether there's been any study on progesterone levels. And I understand that people who have hypothyroids have a hard time with menopause and adrenal gland problems. Is there anything in your book covering those?
Yes, I have a long appendix in which I give what the FDA and other, the official labeling on what these drugs, what's really known about these alternatives. And I must say, again, that a lot of people like some of the alternatives. And I've heard from many women over the years who felt lousy on Prempro and Premarin, and they felt much better on these, what are called these bio-identical products.
The compounding of
But on the other hand, you know, they're not really bio-identical. They're bio-copies, because even though they have the same molecules as what your body makes, they're not made by the secretions of your body. They're made outside of your body by chemists, and so they aren't identical. That's a misleading term. I hope, along with everyone else, that it will turn out that these are somewhat safer, or maybe a lot safer, but I know that it hasn't been proven yet. We just don't know. Now that we've established a high standard for judging what really happens with the traditional hormone replacement therapies, we have to apply that same standard to the alternative methods, and that's going to take a while.
Are there studies being done on, like, the compounding of wild yam?
I think that there are studies being done. I don't know that there's anything being done that says massive and expensive as the Women's Health Initiative,
I have from friends known that it helps them, and the progesterone seems to help too. Are there studies on that? I'm afraid they'll find something.
There already has been a study. It's just a preliminary study, but a scientist recently reported at a chemistry meeting that there's some over-the-counter progesterone cream that's been very popular that does work in the body the same way as the kind of heavy-duty progesterone pills, and does seem to be causing some of the same side effects that occur in some people. So almost anything that works, the more the action, the more the reaction. I
agree with you.
What?
I agree with you on that, and I understand, like I said earlier, thyroid and adrenal glands are important. Does your book cover anything in that?
No, it doesn't have much on thyroid and the adrenal.
Because the adrenal glands take over and help secrete a little more estrogen when the ovaries quit.
If you're asking about the postmenopausal ovary, first of all, the postmenopausal ovary does continue to secrete some hormones, and I don't think that it's a deficiency disease or anything like that at all. I think it's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say that it's unhealthy when a little girl's estrogen levels change when she becomes pubescent and gets her first period. That's healthy. So why isn't it healthy that when her 30 years of reproductive ability ends and it's time for her to get some time back for herself and not have the monthly bleeding and the headaches and, you know, the bloating and the blues, because menstruation is quite unpleasant for quite a few women, and they actually are very happy when they get menopause.
Yes, we are.
Well, Well, I'm so glad you said that, because you realize that that's very rarely mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should celebrate menopause.
And how do you spell your last name?
Oh, that's a bit of an embarrassment, because I wrote this book about the pill. It's semen spelt like sailor, not like sperm.
Okay,
S-E-A-M-A-N. But I do think that the normal body, most of the time, does adjust to what the levels are supposed to be. There may be a period of transition of a few months to a few years where a certain percentage of women are really uncomfortable. I think the figure is about 1 in 6. The only place where there's a big mystery, though, is the woman who's had her ovaries surgically removed. And that's a whole other story that concerns me very much. It concerned Charlie Dodds, too. And it may be that for women who've had their ovaries removed prior to menopause, women who've had them removed, particularly if they're young, in their 20s and 30s, they may need more outside help. In those cases, I think it might be more. You know, the benefits and risk might have a different equation.
Well,
but we
you.
Don't know that for sure yet either. We have a lot of research we should do.
Thank you for all your research.
Thanks for the call. In recent years, before the Women's Health Study of 2002 that really raised the big questions about hormonal replacement, physicians were making a lot of claims about what it might do. And it turned out now, it seems, in light of recent studies, exaggerated claims. But at the same time, what they were doing, they had been looking at women at the point of menopause and looking at the fact that their risks of osteoporosis went up and heart disease went up, and that the argument was made that if you can do something for women that would improve their quality of life, that would help them lower their risk of disease, would make them feel better, would allow them to continue to be sexually active if they wanted to, that all of that taken together was a good thing. I mean, what's wrong with that kind of approach?
One of the things that's wrong with it is that the research studies that were presented were phonied up. They were what I call science by press release, what Attorney General Spitzer calls selective disclosure. And to give you very quick examples, there was a famous study, a very good study done by a radiologist named Harry Gannat in 1982, where he followed different groups of women, some of whom were getting high doses of Premarin, some low doses, and some getting placebos. And they were going through menopause, and he followed them to see if they retained their bone mass. And yes, the women who had the relatively high doses of Premarin maintained their bone mass. Better than the women who weren't getting the placebo. However, what it said in his paper, but what was never told to the women who were being urged to take it, or even to the average doctor who was being urged to prescribe it, was that all of these women had their ovaries removed surgically. These were castrated women, and if you take out a woman's ovaries, particularly before she's had menopause, she goes through a very extreme menopause that's almost overnight, you know, with huge bodily changes. And for those women, the bone loss in some cases was so severe that, yes, it seemed like it was prudent to give them the Premarin, but women were made to feel that this applied to women going through a natural menopause. I watched year after year, as I heard the study constantly misrepresented at doctors' meetings, at their continuing medical education programs, and at meetings for women, at women's health days, where the doctors were then repeating the false information to the women. So there you go. We still don't know how much difference it really makes if you give it to a woman going through normal menopause, because we don't even know whether it's healthy to keep taking any kind of supplement for your bones till you get to 80, which is when the hip fractures begin to occur in a serious way and when it really becomes a lethal situation. Now, another example is the Alzheimer's. That was another one that made me insane. It was so misleading what they were doing. Some of these studies of patients with Alzheimer's involved asking the patients whether they had taken estrogen and then comparing the percentage who said they had taken estrogen with the percentage of women who didn't have Alzheimer's. And they came up with a conclusion that the women who didn't who had Alzheimer's had taken much less estrogen. And they published papers based on that. Now, remember, they were publishing papers based on the memories of women with Alzheimer's. So some smarter researchers said, let's go back and check the pharmacy records. Now, that's not so easy to do, but in England they were able to do it because they have the health service where they keep track of all the pharmacy records. And at Kaiser Permanente they were able to do it because they keep track of the pharmacy records. And guess what? The women who had Alzheimer's had taken just as much, if not more, estrogen than the women who didn't have Alzheimer's, but they forgot. I mean, now what kind of a study is this if you question women who have no memory about what drugs they took years and decades before? And what kind of a study is this if you conceal that studies that the information which seems to indicate that estrogen does a lot to preserve bone mass during menopause was done on women who'd had their ovaries removed? So that's the kind of stuff that's been going on. It was a triumph of marketing over science. And we're finding out now that many other many other areas of pharmacy followed these clever, deceitful programs and ways of marketing that were devised over the many decades by the hormone companies. And there's a wonderful book that's coming out which talks about how the whole drug industry now is full of this kind of deceitful marketing. It's called, have you heard about The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It?
I don't believe I have. That's the title?
Yes, it's by Marcia Angel, MD, who is the past, she's the past editor of nothing less than the New England Journal of Medicine. It's a very hard-hitting book, and it's coming out by Random House at the end of August.
Well, we should see if we could get her on our show.
What?
We should see if we should get her on this program. We can talk about that.
Oh, I think that you would be stunned and startled by everything she has to say.
Pardon me for jumping in on you, but we've simply exhausted our time and we're going to have to stop. To people who would like to read more on the subject, I would just say again, you can look for the book that we have talked about. It's titled The Greatest Experiment Ever Performed on Women, published by Hyperion, by our guest Barbara Seaman. And Ms. Seaman, we want to say again, thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
Thank you so much for reading my book and asking me the questions that I most like to be asked. You were very kind.
Thank you. Our program here, Focus 580, made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. And that's it for us here on Focus, but up next it's the Afternoon Magazine. We want you to stay tuned. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with dog trainers Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel.